Segundo here, and I was a bit confused about half of a yellow sun. You see, I haven't seen the sun in almost 3-4 weeks, and I thought that this book might be a primer for someone like me to get on the wagon and become one once again with the glorious sunshine. Maybe finding a new way to reintegrate into society. Sadly, no such advice or remedy was present in this particular book, but there was, as our young roving correspondent learned, a good deal of sex in this book, and this helped me to get over a dry spot, if you catch my drift. So while I might not see the sun for quite some time, at least this book helped me to diminish my Kleenex supply.
Okay, so I'm here with Chimamanda Adichie, who is the author of Half of a Yellow Sun. Chimamanda, how are you doing?
I'm very well.
Okay, it took 2 attempts to pronounce it sort of mostly correctly. So I wanted to actually ask you, you know, I'm going to frame a question that has kind of been asked of you many times for this book, but I had a discussion with a friend of mine about how young writers often do these really ambitious books, you know, involving war and involving things that they don't witness. In fact, we talked about your book, we talked about Stephen Crane's The Red Badge of Courage. So I wanted to actually ask you, instead of just asking you how this book came about and why this particular incident in history, I was wondering if you could actually illuminate us on some of the literary antecedents, or were those a factor at all?
No. And I think it's a great question. But I think that looking at it that way somehow suggests that it was some sort of literary and intellectual exercise. When it was less that and more, in many ways, more an emotional thing, you know. That the reason I wrote about this war wasn't necessarily because it's a good subject and it's a means of being ambitious, but because this war isn't just, you know, because in some ways it's my history. It's that I wanted to make sense of this time. It's that I wanted to pay tribute to my grandfathers. So it's so much more than. And when I was thinking about, but of course reading sort of war novels helped. I read a lot of those because I just wanted to. And yeah, I mean, I knew I wanted to have many characters. I knew I didn't want to have the small, I didn't want to make it small. Again, not because I was ambitious, although I suppose I was in some ways. But it was because I thought to do this portrait, I just can't have one single point of view, you know. And of course, also I was thinking about those horrible Nigerian reviewers who, no, I'm joking.
Gotcha.
I wanted to give them many things that they can get angry about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in terms of, I guess, why was literature the great prism with which to actually focus this visceral reaction? Now, that seems a basic question, but I ask it in light of the fact that you were confessing earlier about looking at what other people had done.
Yeah.
Did looking at other books kind of allow for this sort of prism of how to filter all these emotions inside you onto this mammoth 600-page novel? Did these help you in any way?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that I think that not just with this book, that if I didn't read, I would be a worse writer. That, I mean, you know, of course. Some of the books that I really liked, which it isn't fiction, it's sort of a memoir, A Woman in Berlin. I really liked that because I remember feeling that I'm also really a believer in the small detail, that the best way to get into a large story is, you know, the smaller your story, the smaller the details are, the smaller your approach, the better it is. And I really love that book because it does it so well. And so it's writing in small ways about what these women went through, but it really gave me a sense of what it was like to be in that part of Berlin, to have the Russians coming, to have the sense of fear that's palpable, to, you know, to be female at that time. I really love that book, and I remember reading it quite early on when I was walking on this and thinking, you know, if people have the same feeling I have reading this book after reading mine, then, you know, then I've achieved what I wanted to achieve. I also quite liked J.G. Ballard, Empire and the Sun.
Yeah.
In a different way, I found it a very cold book.
Well, he's a very cold writer.
Yeah. But there was something about it as well that I thought having this child be the narrator of a huge story about the Second World War also made me think, you know, that in some ways having the unlikely narrator, which is why I had the houseboy, because you usually don't have, at least not in a lot of African fiction, you know, sort of the domestic help being the main storyteller. So that was another book that helped quite a bit.
Going to this idea of little details, I actually wanted to remark upon the many twins in this book. It's not just the twin sisters, but also, for example, little details like the twin journalist's name, Charles, from America. I wanted to sort of ask you about this, because in each of the cases of these twins, it almost represents a kind of either-or scenario.
Yeah.
They are definitely sort of, they're twins, they're attached, but they are completely different in character makeup and in quality. And I was wondering if this was kind of your way of sort of presenting a kind of thematic sort of exemplar of like two different trajectories that one could have taken during that particular time in that particular region.
I think that's really interesting that you say that. Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's, you know, I guess when I was researching this book, a lot of the writing about the way that the rest of the world looked at the war was often that, you know, this country was bad, this country was good. So, you know, England was bad to us. America was bad because we were following England. And I remember thinking, well, but there were also journalists who were very sympathetic to the cause. And in some ways, those two chocks, I wanted to say, well, it wasn't just that they were all bad. And even the bad isn't necessarily just bad, because this man who is very sarcastic about the war and very condescending, and he has a brother who's just died in Vietnam. You know, it's that humanizing people and realizing, well, it's a lot more complex. So, yeah, in some ways it was trying to show the wide spectrum in some ways. And also the twins, sort of the Olanna and Kainene, for me, are very different, but also really similar, I think, underneath the, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, I guess, you know, when you think of any war, you think of two sides to it. Yeah. And certainly in this case, there's a lot of... You actually present a very complicated conflict, often through sort of two sides clashing with each other, through racism or through starvation or through just generally headless corpses in the streets. And I'm wondering if I guess these sort of dichotomies along the lines of twins were sort of the way that you can kind of reach this particular emotional access point in writing about this.
I think so. I mean, you know, I hadn't thought about it until you bring it up now, but I think so. I think that in some ways the way that I look at writing is that sense in which you just don't want to bring one side of something. You want, because you're always thinking about things having two sides, if not more. And for me, I'm interested in sort of doing the two sides. And I think in a lot of my fiction, not just in this book, that you know, you could sort of extend that twin analogy to a lot of my writing, I think.
Does the sort of twin exemplar that we're sort of talking about, does this allow you to kind of get into these gray areas? And kind of related to this question, I have to ask you about the fact that every character in this book is sleeping with somebody else, and that there is no actual sort of monogamous marriage exemplar in any of the characters, in any of the major characters for the most part. And this struck me as kind of interesting. It's a very sensual book, certainly, but it's not just that, but it's also, it seemed to sort of suggest to me that one could not be loyal in one's relationship, and therefore one could not be loyal to any of these causes that were actually occurring in Nigeria at the time. I was wondering if you could sort of describe how the relationship and the loyalty in a relationship to, or the presumed loyalty, depending upon what sort of arrangement you have, and how, if you've got permission, but that's a whole other sidetrack. Sorry, I'll shut up. Go for it.
Okay, now that's really interesting. I have to think about that. That the parallel between the relationship and the cause. I don't know. I think what I wanted to do with that was simply to say human beings are flawed. We're hopelessly flawed. And you know, and also in some ways too, because my parents would tell me stories about the war, and often I would be thinking, wondering how much it changed their relationship. And when I would ask people questions or read things about the war, and there's a lot of sort of people sleeping with each other, as there is everywhere, I think. It made me wonder about how relationships change when, you know, you have a relationship and everyone's happy and your life is comfortably middle class and you're sort of having cucumber sandwiches. And then suddenly you're reduced to this place where you are thinking about eating lizards. It has to do something to the way you have sex. You know, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
And I guess also just to show how our ability to forgive, you know, how in war horrible things are happening, but then you're finding yourself forgiving the person you love who's hurt you, who's betrayed you, you know. And I sort of saw them as, you know, it's difficult for them to be loyal to one another, but they're struggling to be loyal to this big thing, this cause, this faith in something bigger than they are. And I think there's a part of me that's hopelessly romantic, and I just love the idea of believing in something, you know, standing up for something. And we don't have that in Nigeria anymore, and it depresses me. But you know that these people... you know, that people like my parents, for example, who, again, sort of were happily middle class and comfortable, but then my father was willing to walk miles to go walk for the cause. My mother didn't mind that she had to stand in line for her children because she believed. And that, for me, is, you know, it's a bigger romance than just the love. You know, it's a... anyway, okay, so... so, yeah, I... But also I wanted, in some ways, I wanted to have a very forthright, matter-of-fact approach to sexuality, which I don't see in a lot of African writing, particularly women writing in Africa. And I think that in some ways I want to challenge the idea that being a female African writer means you sort of have to be very careful how you approach sexuality because, you know, we all want to keep things comfortable. And I don't want to keep things comfortable, you know. And I get a lot of emails from people saying... You know, the only thing I did not like about this book is that you write about sex. And I think, yes, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
And usually Nigerians...
Lighten up, you know. Well, no, I mean, I mentioned this parallel because I was observing the Richard Churchill character. Mm. And he is the only character who sort of is kind of like this serial adulterer. You know what I mean? And so it made... And since he is likewise...
No, but he's not. I think that the professor is... If anybody is a serial adulterer or comes close to being, I think it's the professor. I think Richard, in some ways... I don't think, and certainly not willfully. Richard cheats on the woman he loves only because he is weak.
Yeah.
In ways that the professor is sort of the strong.
Yeah, you don't think. No, I think what it is he's in the relationship and then he goes to another one twice in the book. And that to me was interesting because he also writes two books.
Yeah.
You know, one initially about the Igbo art and the later one about, you know, trying to understand the war.
Yeah.
And that's, they that's
really,
why...
don't really succeed, those books.
No.
But he cheats only once. He cheats only once.
I'm sorry.
So it's this one slip that he completely... you know, regrets afterwards.
Yeah.
So I didn't see him. I mean, if anybody, I think in some ways the idea of male privilege and the double standards, I think I wanted to use the professor to explore that because, you know, he cheats on the woman he loves and he says, it wasn't really my fault, my mother made me do it. And it's the kind of thing one hears quite often in Nigeria where men will say things like, I didn't do it, somebody else made me.
Yeah.
And then later in the war, she thinks he's done it again. And I don't know whether he does. We don't know. But it's the idea that he could have, you know, that I found interesting.
Yeah.
He could have, and it would have sort of been okay. He would have gotten away with it. You know, it would have been acceptable in some ways.
Maybe we can sort of talk about the difference between writing male characters and writing female characters. Perhaps some of these sexual affairs kind of assisted you in sort of, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
they're often very specific, I must say.
Yes, and, you know, intentionally so. And I also, you know, quite frankly, I find that when I... You know, I think I suppose I do. I like to think that I write the kind of fiction that I like to read, you know. And when I'm reading sexual scenes in fiction, I don't like it when they're very vague and when it's about sort of the waves carried her up and lifted her. I like it when it's specific. So I guess my approach is, you know, this is the kind of thing I like to read. I'm going to write it this way. But also, I think it says a lot about the relationships themselves, you know, that Olanna and Odeniboy want it to be very sexual and intense. They really do have this love that is so intense, but also very flawed, you know. And when I was writing Ugwu, the houseboy, wasn't very difficult to do. And he's actually the character I most identify with in some ways because he... I think he's me. I think he's an observer like I am. He is idealistic in many ways, as I think I am. But also he has this part of him that's harshly realistic, which I think I do as well. But writing Richard, the Englishman, was difficult. And it was, you know, I was thinking he's a white man. You know, this is going to be hard. And initially, the sections with Richard were really very bad because I was very stiff and the style was different because in my head I was thinking he's a white man.
Yeah.
And I think at some point, reading them, I knew they were bad. You know, you sort of know that it's bad, but you don't know how to fix it. And then later, I thought, I need to remember that he's human.
Yeah.
You know, he's white and there's all of that baggage that comes with it, but underneath that, he's needy, he's insecure, he's well-meaning. And then it became easy. He just became this human being who was needy and insecure and well-meaning. But I think also, but he's I remember thinking, this is the part that I'm most, not uncomfortable, but... So, for example, Richard's sections I always sent to my friend, who's an Englishman, to read when I was walking on, because, you know, I thought, okay, what are they going to attack me on? And so I would send them to him and say, tell me one thing that doesn't sound right. You know, he's not you, of course, but you are English. You were sort of born around that time, because this Englishman is in his 70s. And so I thought, read it and tell me what you just think doesn't work. And so he would point out things and I would change them, you know. So that helped. It sort of helped having a real-life male person to refer to.
This will be my last sex question, I promise. But it's kind of borderline on sex, actually. But I wanted to actually ask about skin in this book. I observed, particularly in these very specific sort of descriptions, that skin was of, you know, was frequently described, the sensation of being next to someone. And then near the end of the book, as all manner of carnage and violence actually unloads, I noticed that there were a lot of slaps to the face, not using a weapon so much among the main, you know, ensemble of characters. And so I wanted to, this is probably why I saw this kind of connection also between fidelity and for one's country and fidelity for one's relationship. Maybe was and this is a totally unusual question, I know, but I'm very curious, was skin or this idea of like being in one's kind of natural corporeal element, was this something that you were thinking about when you were writing this book or
Now, was I thinking about skin?
Or were you thinking about like this I mean, was,
you know, it's you know what's interesting about writing, and I'm sure that you probably understand this since you write, is that it's not always a conscious thing. I mean, these are things that when you in retrospect you sort of think, yes, maybe I was, but when you're walking on it, you're not entirely conscious. I know that I'm very interested in the senses. You know, sort of I'm interested in sensuality in fiction, and of course in race, which I guess, I don't know if I, you know, by the way, the slapping on the face is just because Nigerians do a lot of that.
Oh, okay. that's often the case always with these questions.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I was aware. I mean, I certainly was aware of just the wanting to have a sensual approach to things. And not just touch, smell, and, you know, that's just that idea that I want my reader to feel as much as possible.
There's also the, you know, a lot of references to the body odor, too, and how this is the sort of divide between the you know, the native Igbos and the people who are living these middle-class existences, which is another reason I sort of suggest that skin, or maybe it may very well be this sensuality that was your concern.
I think it's what it is, and, you know, it's that thing where, again, I want to talk about the huge question of class, but I want to do it through things like, you know, smell, that which is the case today, because you sort of you will hear middle class Nigerians saying, oh, I got my houseboy today and he smells so bad, I have to, you know, that sort of thing, and of course you're thinking that this houseboy in his hometown doesn't smell, I mean, to his people it's normal, but he's come to this new place and it smell has become a huge thing. So I think it's probably less that I was thinking about skin in particular, and more that my general approach is one of sensuality, I think.
Did the sensuality sort of come in sort of terms of like the early stages of trying to figure out exactly what your visceral approach on a really grisly Biafran revolution is going to be like? Was that sensuality that kind of allowed you that entry point, perhaps? Or?
I think so, yeah. Because I knew from the beginning, look, this has to be me telling the story in the smallest of ways. And I just did so many revisions, I don't even remember when what happened. I mean, I rewrote this many times. I was actually looking recently at the early versions and thinking how different they were from what's finally finished. But from the beginning, I certainly knew that this was what I wanted to do, that I wanted to have details, I wanted to have the senses, I wanted to...
when in the process of revision, did that shift from like the late 60s to the early 60s to the late 60s, was that one of those things that kind of came about that allowed you to kind of lock the narrative in place, or was this a way to sort of, I guess, add some complexity to the narrative? Because it does come as a surprise, because I had to flip back and forth between like, wait a minute, did I miss something? Yeah. And then like, then it comes, I'm like, oh, okay, thank you.
My brother says he wanted to smack me when he first read it, so it's fine if people, you know. No, I knew... the structure I had from the beginning.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So I actually wrote it in the way that it's arranged. So I wrote the first part, and then I wrote the second part, and then I wrote it in that order. I made some changes, of course, so that people wouldn't be too confused, and I had to find ways to sort of try and remind the reader, okay, we've jumped some years, and although I'm confusing you for no good reason, just stay with me, sort of thing.
I'm wondering if it was a way to sort of, I guess, if you were to have gone entirely from this sort of peaceful pre-revolution Nigeria and then gone completely into the darkness of violence and the like, was this kind of a way to sort of show more of, again, we were talking at the very beginning about twins, and maybe was this a manner of to sort of, I guess, show the contrast between war and peace?
Yeah, absolutely. And also that I didn't want, you know, sometimes you can lose a reader when it's, you know, everything is fine, then suddenly it's horrible and gets even more horrible and it goes all that way to the end. I didn't want to lose my reader. I wanted to keep reminding my reader that these people are human. And at some point they really did have ordinary lives in which they were interested in food and sex and music, you know, and not
high life music too. I was going to ask you about that because I didn't get a chance to research that, but there are numerous references to high life. Yes. I mean, can you recommend any good titles?
Yes, I can. High life apparently originated in Ghana. I don't know a lot about Ghanaian high life, but Nigerian high life, who would be? I don't know if Ike Dairo. Actually, I think I have some names in the book. Ike Dairo is D-A-I-R-O. Okay. I think is a good place to start. But it was the 60s. I mean, high life was hugely popular in Nigeria. And what I liked about it particularly was that it cut across class. Yeah. So, you know, the big men were listening to high life and the little guys were listening to high life as well. I sort of really liked that and I wanted to push high life in the book so people would read it and say, oh, I want to go listen to high life.
Yeah, well, I mean, you mentioned it so many times that now, you know, I want to go check it out too, certainly.
I know, I think sometimes the reader might say, all right, shut up, we're ready about high life.
Yeah. Oh, I wanted to describe the notion of both, is it Odenegbo?
Yeah, that's close.
Oh, that's close, okay. Odenegbo, hopefully it's close enough.
Yeah.
And Richard, and Ugwu. I wanted to mention the whole notion of education in this book.
Yeah.
Ugwu is educating himself throughout the course of this book.
Yeah.
And likewise, you have with Odenegbo, he is into math. And this kind of suggested to me that they were not putting all of their focus in their particular disciplines. I wanted to going back to another twin, the idea of being a revolutionary versus being a mathematician, and also the idea of being a sort of servant and yet being educated in a manner. I mean, it's almost as if education during this time period, as you presented in this book, is by no means a way to kind of, I guess, launch great plans. No amount of sort of schooling that you can do can really sort of allow you to sort of, I guess, exist in these particular worlds. You can't win. So what of these bookish snares throughout this text?
No, I think two things. That yes, education isn't enough, I think is the point. That it's important because now you live in this new colonial post-colonial, whatever the heck that means, place where it is important for you to have that degree and to play according to the rules, but also to have a different kind of education, which isn't that sort of colonial Western thing, which I think Ugwu has a lot of.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that you say that. I think it's actually quite appropriate to see Odenigbo's character as sort of a twin in its own right, because it's so unlikely he's a mathematician, but he's also this crazy... crazy-talking, revolutionary, self-made.
Yeah.
And I wanted in some ways to... I mean, apart from the fact that my father, being a professor of statistics and having books on mathematics at home, made it easy for me to create a character who, you know, had studied mathematics. But also I didn't want him to be too conventional. I mean, I didn't want him to sort of be the politician who's also revolutionary. I just wanted to show, look, it is possible to, on the one hand, have studied math, then be this crazy. But I think also that at the time, you know, this was 1960s Nigeria. A lot of African countries had become newly decolonized. And there was a strong Pan-African sentiment. And so you had people who, it didn't matter, quite matter what your discipline was, you were political and fiercely so. You were angry about South Africa. You wanted to know what was going on in Algeria and Zambia, you know, and in the US. And so I sort of wanted to portray that time, that really political time, intensely political, also intensely ideological, when people were, you know, crazily hopeful about what Africa would become, or, you know.
But it's also about sort of an absolute versus relative idea. This, you know, math is a very absolute sort of thing. It's like, you know, an either or. It's very much a binary kind of thing.
Yeah.
Revolution, on the other hand, it's like things go completely
But in some ways, his approach to revolution is absolute, isn't it? I mean, I don't think that he as a character quite understands, until the war starts, how relative ideology itself is, how, you know, how nothing is set in stone. He doesn't seem to get
that.
That's true.
But he does, I guess, as he sees all these massacres happen,
he's forced to.
Which he really sort of can't believe. And maybe there is something to that, but there is at least this change in his character, whereas in those who carry on these terrible racism and terrible slaughters, there is nothing, you know?
Yeah.
Well, anyways, I want to actually talk about the violence in this book. You describe it often very sparsely. The bodies are decapitated, their people are massacred through brutal racism. I mean, but you don't dwell on, like, really elaborate detail of these particular, of this violence.
Yeah.
It's very sort of, I mean, and even Ugwu's finale near the end, I mean, his choice at that bar, it's only like a half page of ethical vacillation. So I wanted to kind of ask you about that. Do you feel that sort of stopping short sometimes it really conveys the complexities of war?
Yeah.
Was this an issue for you, or is this more about the narrative than it is about depicting war?
I think it's about both. I do think that in much the same way that details work better when you're writing about something huge, I also feel that when you're writing about something difficult and violent, that that less is more, you know, and that sometimes you run the risk of having it become pornographic, if that makes sense, when you're... I didn't see myself, I didn't want to, quite frankly, describe those bodies over and over. I sometimes feel that one tiny detail is enough. I remember reading something about Toni Morrison where she said, for her, sex scenes were, she tells the reader the man is on top, the woman is underneath, and she leaves it there, you know. And I remember reading that and thinking, and she lets the reader, she thinks that's enough. All you need to know is that, you know, who's on top or who's, you know, and then you make up the rest.
Yeah.
I don't share that when it comes to sexuality. I sort of want to tell you what happens. But when it comes to violence, I think I do. I want to give you a tiny detail, and then I just don't want it to get... I think that it's very easy to go overboard with violence, and it makes me uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And I think it also might have something to do with the fact that I was always aware that I was writing about something that really did happen to people.
Yeah.
And there's a kind of... I don't know if it's respect, maybe it's humility that I wanted to bring to those scenes, you know, of violence.
I can totally see what you're saying, but doesn't this kind of get in the way of pursuing the truth further and really getting at this piece?
No, I don't think so. I actually think that sometimes it might make you closer to the truth.
Hmm.
Yeah, I really don't think that... you know, you're writing a rape scene, for example. And, I mean, there's a point in which one... you know, that sometimes overdoing it and overwriting it, you can become untruthful. Your reader can stop believing you, I think. I mean, I think as a reader that if I read a rape scene in which I thought, okay, there are too many details, there's too much going on, I don't believe this anymore, you know. And again, I have to go back to A Woman in Berlin, that book I love, and where she writes about rape, of course, but she also writes, I will never forget this really tiny detail of a soldier who rapes a woman and then spits in her mouth.
Yeah.
And that stayed with me because I thought this is just the most humiliating thing, and it's just this tiny detail.
Yeah.
And in that detail, I just found it so powerful and so, you know, in a way that I wouldn't have, I think, if I had been given all the details about what happened when she was raped.
So on this subject, it's really a matter of, I guess, the reader's imagination versus give it to the reader.
Yeah.
And this delicate sort of balance, I guess, it's interesting that, do you think that, have you been working to pursue violence or confronting the terrors of our time, or either the terrors of another time, or the terrors of any time? Yeah. Have you been working to sort of confront this in your writing?
Oh, yeah. But I think, when you say the reader's imagination, it is that, but you also have to give the reader enough to work with. When I teach creative writing classes, I often talk about significant detail, that it isn't just detail for detail's sake, that it has to, it has to be the best detail possible.
Yeah.
And then you let the reader, that the reader needs enough. You just can't, in the end, it's your story and you have to bloody tell it the best way possible.
Yeah.
And it's something I'm still working. I think it's something that I will always work on, that I sort of think that can always be better, if that makes sense,
Oh, I wanted to actually ask about the role of names in this book. You have, My Good Man between the Ugwu and Odenigbo. And you also have the baby that is simply named Baby. There's a kind of irony to much of the, kind of way that people refer to each other in the book. And maybe you can talk about how that sort of came to be. Did you feel that you needed kind of comedy sort of touches to sort of go against the seriousness?
Yeah, I hope the book would be funny. I wanted it to, but it's sort of a wry kind of humor. The My Good Man is my way of poking fun at, and I find that I actually say My Good Man. It's just one of those horrible Britishisms that Nigerians picked up, particularly Nigerians of Odenibo's class. So here he is calling Ugwu My Good Man, and it's just incongruous because Ugwu doesn't get it. But then, of course, later, Ugwu starts to call him My Good Man. And with Baby, I think I don't know what I wanted to do with her. I just sort of thought that, that she would just be Baby. And maybe in some ways it was my way of saying that she becomes not just the specific baby, but she comes to represent all the young people, I remember thinking, because I didn't know how the book would end. And so when I started, I thought Baby would die. And so of course she doesn't die. But maybe when I named her Baby, I think I sort of imagined somehow in my head that later she would die, and then, we could sort of read that as all the kids who died, and I don't know.
Yeah, gosh.
But then, of course, she doesn't die, so hey.
Is this, would you call this a political book, and what is the sort of Venn diagram between politics and literature?
Would I call this a political book? You know what, I really have problems with that idea, that label, because, it somehow suggests a book that, sort of like medicine, it's not good for you, but it's good for you, but you can't, you have to struggle to get it down. And I like to think of literature as fun, that I grew up loving books because I enjoy them and not because I thought they were good for me. But I suppose it is. I think most books are political. I think most, and politics and literature, I don't know.
Well, let me, considering your answer, do you think that, one can actually enjoy a book and deals with atrocities like
absolutely.
This?
Oh, absolutely.
Or at least that section, the reader might be, obviously is going to be repelled. Is that a form of enjoyment?
Maybe we shouldn't say enjoyment. Maybe we should say appreciation. Sorry.
Sure, no problem. Is that one of those iPhones?
No, it's not. It's a... I don't even know what it is. It's actually a present I got in Nigeria.
Oh.
So it's not... So I took it to T-Mobile, which is what I use. And I said, I have this phone. And they said, did you get it from overseas? And I said, yes, but can you put my bloody SIM card in it? But no, really, thinking about... It's one of those things that I think about constantly. I don't have answers. Politics and literature. Often you find that books that are set... you find that in the US and in England, books that are set in a different country and then deals with something vaguely political becomes a political text.
Yeah.
In ways that Philip Roth, for example, who deals a lot with political things, doesn't quite get labeled political text, And I love Philip Roth. I think he's fun, but also serious. And I think it's possible to do that. And it's possible to, if not enjoy, but to appreciate, that everything can't all be fun, because life isn't all fun. And I find that I'm actually drawn to literature that's about something. You know, I want to learn. I mean, I want to have fun, but also I want to learn, if that makes sense. Who did I read recently? I really like Ian McEwan. I really liked the book Saturday, which I didn't understand why many people didn't like it, but I really liked it. And I liked that it was, I enjoyed reading it, but also that it was political in many ways. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is it a matter of, I guess, again, going back to what we were sort of talking about in terms of prisms?
Mm.
I mean, is that really what it is? Is that it's not so much a matter of sermonizing as it is reflecting some sort of environment or some sort of issue like politics?
Yeah. I think that the idea of sermonizing in fiction is horrible and it's just going to be bad, you know. And I also think that label, it's political fiction, somehow suggests that one is writing polemic and that it's going to be boring and terrible, which it doesn't have to be. I mean, I think the best political fiction is fun and great and, you know. And I don't think it's the job of fiction to sermonize, quite frankly, you know. I think it's the job of fiction to, you know, write about character and also to write about the improbable, you know, the incongruous, that these people who claim to have lofty ideas also cheat on the women they love and also, you know, eat lizards. I mean, I think that's what the job of fiction is, and that's what makes political fiction good when it's done well, because it can be bad. And I've read some of those.
Yeah, there definitely is. I know you have to go, but Chimamanda, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thanks for, now I'm going to, now in my head I have that twin idea.